my fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and restore control of that country to its own people. And you can know that our forces will be coming home as soon as their work is done. Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities. Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures, and we will accept no outcome but victory.
By Toby Harnden, telegraph.co.uk, January 20th, 2003. The headline, Americans Protest Against the Iraq War. Saddam Hussein has hailed the anti-war protest in the United States on the weekend as proof that Americans back Iraq rather than President George W. Bush. A group called Answer Act Now to Stop War and Racism, which organized the rallies, claimed that 500,000 turned up in Washington, making it the biggest protest since the Vietnam War. Police estimates range between 100,000 and 200,000, and there were a few speakers from the mainstream of the Democratic Party at the rally. It was part of a weekend of global protests, with demonstrations from Moscow to Paris, Berlin, Cairo, and Damascus. Most polls showed that roughly 60% of Americans favor military action. But it was not clear whether the rallies would sway public opinion. Mr. Bush spent the weekend at Camp David, far away from the demonstrators. With Congress in recess, there were very few Capitol Hill politicians in Washington to see the huge crowds gather. And the media ignored us at the time. Nobody paid any mind to us. The biggest protests since the Vietnam War. And they say, you know what? That's just a bunch of uptight liberals in America who clearly have a problem with freedom. One speaker declared, if you want to fight terrorism, then fight the terror of miseducation and youth unemployment and greedy monopoly capitalism. If you're looking for an axis of evil, then look to the belly of the beast.
Aloha. I'm Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard. As a veteran of two Middle East deployments, I know firsthand the cost of war. I know how important it is that our commander-in-chief has the sound judgment required to know when to use America's military power and when not to use that power. As a vice chair of the DNC, I'm required to stay neutral in Democratic primaries, but I cannot remain neutral any longer. The stakes are just too high. That's why today I'm endorsing Senator Bernie Sanders to be our next president and commander-in-chief of the United States. We need a commander-in-chief who has foresight, who exercises good judgment, and who understands the need for a robust foreign policy which defends the safety and security of the American people, and who will not waste precious lives and money on interventionist wars of regime change.
One counter-protester at the rally said, I am exercising my constitutional right to free speech. This is somebody who was for the war and against the people that were protesting. I wish the Iraqi people had the same right. I support military intervention and regime change in Iraq. Clearly, he did not like the mood. Clearly, he did not like the idea of not going to war. Everybody has their issue when it comes to government, when it comes to elections, when it comes to who one picks for president. Everybody has their issue. My name is Melvin, and my issue is war.
So what if a bunch of libtard, hippie, nobody, pacifist, panty waste were protesting America's mighty, mighty military? So what That's just a bunch of Americans that don't know how good they have it.
Also, from telegraph.co.uk, and remember, I had to get these articles from foreign sources because the American media was not covering us. They didn't care. Nobody knew how many folks were against the war. Why? Because at that time, our media was actively promoting the war. Quoting here, Britain witnessed its largest demonstration when an estimated 1 million protesters took to the streets of London to oppose the looming war against Iraq. The center of the capital was paralyzed by noisy but peaceful people from many political backgrounds. Former members of the armed forces, clergymen, and young children all joined the march to Hyde Park. On a bright but chilly day, thousands of demonstrators carried banners with the messages such as "No war on Iraq," "Make tea, not war." The crowds at the two starting points on the embankment and Gower Street were so large that the police began to march early for safety reasons. When the two strands finally met in Piccadilly Circus, there were deafening cheers from the thousands who gathered around the statue of Eros. Others sounded their horns and banged drums. Large peace protests were also held all over the country. And around the world, up to 60,000 protesters gathered in Glasgow and up to 90,000 in Dublin, while Italy had the biggest protest with an estimated 2 million peace campaigns on the streets of Rome. Some organizers from the Stop the War Coalition claimed that 2 million people had taken part in the protest, nearly five times the 400,000-plus crowd that took part in the countryside march last September.
And it's very close to my heart because I was down there. And I watch our police and our firemen down in 7-Eleven, down at the World Trade Center, right after it came down.
This from Crooks and Liars. The media is promoting war again, just like they did in 2003. They paid no attention to us back then. 13 years later, there seems to be this amnesia and there seems to be this forgiveness on the part of George W. Bush, forgiveness on the part of Donald Rumsfeld and John Yoo, and all these folks that were promoting war at the time, and all these congressmen that voted for war. This from Crooks and Liars. Ron Allen parroted right-wing criticisms on Obama instead of being a real journalist. Quote, I think a lot of people around the world in America are concerned because given the strategy that you are pursuing in what has been more than a year now, ISIS capability seems to be expanding. We're all concerned about ISIS. Where were you when they had the capability of pulling off the kind of attack they did in Paris? Are you concerned and do you think they have the same capability to strike in the United States? And do you think that given all you've learned about ISIS over the last year or so, given all the criticism about your understanding them, do you think you really understand this enemy well enough to defeat them and protect the homeland? A CNN reporter using heated language when asking the president about how he's going to defeat ISIS. I guess the question is, if you'll forgive the language, why can't we take out these bastards? CNN's Jim Acosta asked. When Tulsi Gabbard decided to leave the DNC, and the DNC, who we know now, colluded to make sure that Hillary Clinton could become the nominee, of course it wasn't going to be foolproof because Sanders did put up a good fight. But when she left the DNC, her issue too was war. And I understood it. Back in 2003, when I heard about it, I was among the protesters, and I honestly did not think that we would go to war. I did not think that the American people would stand for it, but there were two problems. One, nobody was paying attention. Two, even if they had been paying attention, the media had them fixated on other things. So after Tulsi Gabbard quit the DNC and came out in support of Senator Sanders, based largely on this one issue alone, then she decided to cut an ad for him.
Being a warrior is about believing in what you are fighting for and holding strong to those convictions. I felt a sense of duty and I could not in good conscience stay back here in beautiful Hawaii and watch my brothers and sisters in uniform go off into combat. These are people and friends who we never forget and who we strive to honor every day that we are blessed to live and breathe. Bernie Sanders voted against the Iraq war. He understands the cost of war, that cost is continued when our veterans come home. Bernie Sanders will defend our country and take the trillions of dollars that are spent on these interventionist regime change unnecessary wars and invest it here at home. The American people are not looking to settle for inches. They're looking for real change.
I have made mistakes in my life. And when I reflect back on those mistakes, some of them, they're not like voting for a war. But some of the mistakes that I've made in my life, I'm so embarrassed I don't even like recounting the stories. If I have to, I will recount the stories to my children because I feel there is an important lesson in it. But when I tell those stories, I do not do so without clear shame on my face and regret, sometimes deep within my heart. Hillary Clinton's war vote, and I want to be fair here, she was not the only one to vote for the war, nor was her vote a decisive vote. But you have blood on your hands. I remember picking on Bush people back in the run-up to the Iraq War and saying to them, you're going to have blood on your hands. If you cast a vote for this man, you're going to have blood on your hands. And then he was reelected in 2004. And I said, you knew what he was doing. You knew that he was lying. You still cast a vote for him, and you have blood on your hands. Then in 2008, I voted for then-Senator Barack Obama to be president. I couldn't back Hillary Clinton. She voted for the war. I backed Barack Obama. Barack Obama continued George Bush's wars. Now, to be fair, you have to get out of them responsibly. I'll say that. So there was going to be some killing. There was going to be some sort of war. But I feel like it could have been carried out differently. I feel like fewer people could have died. Yes, we've been getting out of those wars, but not fast enough. We should have never gotten into them. The gates of hell were opened up when we went into the Middle East, especially going into Middle East without an exit plan. And I said, so this is what it's like to have blood on your hands. I voted for this man, and these wars are still going. I, too, have blood on my hands. And I say that with deep shame and deep regret. Did I kill anybody? Did I actually go and cast a vote for the actual war? No, of course I didn't. I'm not a congressman. I can't do that. I'm a layman. I'm a nobody. But even I knew that there was no justification for the Iraq war. But even still, I say so now. Quite honestly, there was nobody to vote for in 2008, and I thought Obama was pretty good. And he's done some great things since. But I can't escape the fact that I have blood on my hands.
There have been a lot of questions about Iraq posed to candidates over the last weeks. I've made it very clear that I made a mistake, plain and simple.
She made a mistake, plain and simple. Yeah, a lot of people died, hundreds of thousands in Iraq, thousands of our own soldiers. Of course, trillions of dollars are still being spent there and will continue to be spent on veterans. We are losing a veteran every day, not to the theater of war, but to suicide.
If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region.
This headline from Common Dreams in November of last year, Patriotism for Sale, the Pentagon's pro-war propaganda scheme with pro sports. Since 2012, the U.S. Department of Defense has paid out $10 million to professional sports teams to stage what they call paid patriotism. Events that use taxpayer money to serve the military's recruitment efforts, according to a new government oversight report. The Pentagon contracted with 72 separate sports teams, including those in the NFL, MLB, and NHL, NASCAR, and Major League Soccer, according to the investigation conducted by Republican Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake, both from Arizona. The events, which range from surprise homecomings and enlistment ceremonies to ceremonial first pitches and Wounded Warrior tributes, were presented as authentic and voluntary, exploiting audiences and dishonoring genuine patriotic partnerships. Moreover, the 10.4 million figure is only a fraction of the military's $53 million total reported expenditures on marketing and advertising contracts with sports teams between 2012 and 2015. And even those numbers may be underreported.
I think that there is a broad and deep misunderstanding of who ISIS is ideologically and operationally. Everybody thinks that you can just bomb these people. And we have been fighting this exact same group since before 9/11, actually since 1991. This is Al-Qaeda's extended ideology, but in sort of a flash mob mentality. Mm-hmm. I don't think Donald Trump has a clue as to who ISIS is. I don't think that he understands the depth of their commitment, and certainly not the ability to root them out. And I certainly hope that he gets some form of advice.
That's Malcolm Nance, who is the author of Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe. He's also a former U.S. Navy Senior Chief Petty Officer in Naval Cryptology. He's written several books on anti-terrorism, and I recommend them. He's very smart and knows his stuff very well, and he's been coming out more and more in the media trying to tell us exactly who we're dealing with now that we have opened the gates to hell. This from Vice.com by Jason Leopold. The headline, the CIA just declassified the document that supposedly justified the Iraq invasion. This came out a year ago in March 2015. And it says, 13 years ago, the intelligence community, so it'll be 14 now, concluded in a 93-page classified document used to justify the invasion of Iraq that it lacked specific information on many key aspects of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein's weapon of mass destruction program. But that's not what top Bush administration officials said during the campaign to sell their war to the American public. Those officials, citing the same classified document, asserting with no uncertain that Iraq was actively pursuing nuclear weapons, concealing a vast chemical and biological weapon arsenal, and posing an immediate and grave threat to national security. The national intelligence estimate that was used to justify the invasion has remained shrouded in mystery until now. It was released thanks to a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request, and we've learned that it was grossly overstated by the Bush administration, i.e., they lied to all of us. We knew that then, but we know that for damn sure now. In October 7th, 2002 speech in Cincinnati, Ohio, then President George W. Bush simply said Iraq possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons, and the evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program. In September 2002, then Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld claimed that the U.S. had bulletproof evidence linking Saddam's regime to the terrorist group. We have solid evidence in Iraq of Al-Qaeda members, including some that have been in Baghdad. We have what we consider very reliable reporting of senior-level contacts going back a decade, and of possible chemical and biological agent training. The NIE also restores previously unknown piece of intelligence, a suggestion that Iraq was possibly behind the letters laced with anthrax sent to news organizations and Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy a week after the 9/11 attacks. The attacks killed 5 people and sickened 17 others. Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. They voted against the resolution to go to war with Iraq. And they just happened to be the 2 guys that got anthrax. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice stated at the time on CNN that the tubes, there was a lot of talk about aluminum tubes at the time, are only really suited for nuclear weapons programs, centrifuge programs, and that we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. According to the latest figures compiled by Iraq Body Count, to date, more than 200,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. 200,000! It's okay, Hillary. You made a mistake. Although other sources say the casualties are twice as high. I've heard even higher than that. But we'll go with the low number because 200,000 is too damn many. More than 4,000 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq. Tens of thousands more have been injured or maimed. The war has cost the taxpayers over $2 trillion. And it's estimated by the time it's over, if it ever ends, it could be 6. In an interview with Vice founder Shane Smith, Obama said the rise of the Islamic State was a direct result of the disastrous invasion. Quote, ISIL is a direct outgrowth of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that grew out of our invasion, which is an example of unintended consequences, which is why we should generally aim before we shoot.
Republicans in February blocked Senator Bernie Sanders' bill to provide $21 billion in medical and other benefits for veterans.
And now we're being told that we cannot afford the Sanders agenda. We cannot afford schools. We cannot afford roads. We cannot afford bridges. We cannot afford the police department. We cannot afford to feed our people. My countrymen are sleeping on the sidewalk in one of the most prosperous parts of the country. And I understand conservatives say, that's because you liberals don't know how to run things. Really? Because quite a few people are doing pretty well around here. And in the red states, those are the people that have more food stamp benefits than anybody in the country. I would say that all of you have it wrong. I hear it from the Republicans. I hear it from the Hillary people. We can't afford to do those things. But you know what we can always afford? We can always afford war.
If you think it's too expensive to take care of veterans, don't send them to war.
Perhaps the reason that Senator Sanders was one of the votes against war was because of his connection to it. I've heard it said by folks who have been in the theater of war that the only people who get excited about war are those who have never been to war. Now, I understand there are some outliers with respect to this. One of them is going to be Senator John McCain, who's pretty jacked up about war, even though he himself was a prisoner of war for 5 years and was tortured. And Bernie wasn't hesitant to lay out during the debates why he felt the way he felt about war.
My father's family was wiped out by Hitler in the Holocaust. I know about what crazy and radical and extremist politics mean. I learned that lesson as a tiny, tiny child when my mother would take me shopping and we would see people working in stores who had numbers on their arms because they were in Hitler's concentration camp. I am very proud of being Jewish, and that is an essential part of who I am as a human being.
But of course, those that have never seen war up close get really excited about it. Bigger and better than that, they get excited about other things that are also very brutal, such as torture. This also from Vice, December 2014. The Senate Select Committee, the headline reading, Senate torture reports find the CIA was less effective and more brutal than anyone knew. Torture, not effective, and way more brutal. The Senate Select Committee, quoting here on Intelligence, released the long-awaited 500-page executive summary from its $40 million report on the CIA's, what they wouldn't call it torture, they called it enhanced interrogation program, which senators have said documents the brutal techniques used against 119 high-level al-Qaeda suspects. The summary, which you can find a PDF of online, examines only 20 CIA captives, includes previously undisclosed details about sexual threats detainees endured during the interrogation sessions, including one in which the interrogator, get the kids out of the room, threatened to sodomize a detainee with a broomstick. The CIA also threatened to murder detainees and their families, the Senate's executive summary says. At least five CIA detainees were subjected to rectal rehydration or rectal feeding without documented medical necessity. And I heard an interview with a doctor about this. He says, you can't feed somebody by putting food up there. I said, get the kids out of the room. What I should have also said was, I apologize ahead of time if you are eating. The CIA placed detainees in ice water baths. The CIA led several detainees to believe that they would never be allowed to leave CIA custody alive, suggesting to one detainee that he would only leave in a coffin-shaped box. One interrogator told another detainee that he would never go to court because we can never let the world know what I have done to you. These folks in the CIA did this in your name. And go ahead, Republicans, say it to me. Say it to my face. Say, that's because of government. Those are the kind of things the government does. No, this was George W. Bush. This was Donald Rumsfeld. And this was a lie to begin with. We should have never been there. And we should have never tortured anybody. Nobody should have ever had to die. And trillions should not have been spent on this war. CIA officers also threatened at least three detainees with harm to their families, to include threats to harm the children of a detainee, threats to sexually abuse the mother of a detainee, and the threat to cut a detainee's mother's throat. Throughout the existence of the program between 2002 and 2006, multiple CIA detainees who were subjected to the enhanced interrogation techniques and extended isolation exhibited psychological and behavioral issues, including hallucinations, paranoia, insomnia, and attempts at self-harm and self-mutilation. Multiple psychologists identified the lack of human contact experienced by detainees as cause of psychiatric problems. But at no point does the committee characterize the interrogation methods that a detainees were subjected to while they were held at the top secret black site prisons as torture. They refuse to call it torture. To this day, the Senate's executive summary concludes that the CIA's use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques was not effective and did not produce any unique and valuable intelligence. In other words, information that the CIA would not have been able to obtain through other means. At no time did the CIA's coercive interrogation techniques lead to the collection of imminent threat intelligence, such as hypothetical ticking time bomb information that many believe was the justification for the use of these techniques. The Senate report also says the CIA used inaccurate information to obtain the legal authorization from the Justice Department to use enhanced interrogation techniques and provide inaccurate information to the White House, Congress, and Justice Department. And for some reason, we don't understand how we ended up with ISIL.
Where does torture play a role in understanding the enemy and the impact it has?
Well, first off, torture absolutely, positively does not work. I was in charge of the program for the Department for the United States Navy. I ran waterboarding program. We teach, and we have an entire history, 239 years of U.S. military personnel captive since the French and Indians.
Why doesn't it work?
It doesn't work.
Why doesn't it work?
Because all it does is it pushes a person to say something. And that's why we have an entire survival, evasion, resistance, and escape school program to teach people how to say the right thing, but not to give up information. We teach it doesn't work.
That was Malcolm Nance appearing on MSNBC with Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. And Joe Scarborough was pretty unhappy about this. Excuse me, no, you cannot say torture does not work because you're talking about my man George W. Bush. You're talking about my party, the Republican Party. You cannot say that torture does not work because it just shatters everything that I believe, even though everything I believe is a lie.
To your position that waterboarding didn't work on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, because there's a lot of intel that suggests that, in fact, it did.
Well, you know, intelligence is intelligence. If a person opens his mouth, and the reason that, again, we teach this is because that person is wasting your time. We actually have an entire Department of Defense program that's been going since the Korean War to teach that the battlefield is across the table. As a matter of fact, Joe, it was the comment that you made back in 2007 that waterboarding was more akin to a fraternity prank, where I wrote my article, Waterboarding is Torture, Period. And that one article changed the Defense Department's entire perspective on waterboarding. It doesn't work. There's documentation it doesn't work. Because the guy opened his mouth and maybe 200 applications of war does not mean that you have successfully gotten intelligence. You've gotten
to speak. You don't get the. I don't remember talking about a fraternity prank, but I certainly do know that the perception that you're trying to get people to talk while they're being waterboarded. And of course, we're talking about something that's in the past tense that'll never be used again. But it's not like you get people to talk while you're waterboarding them. You do talk to them across the table after it happened, and at least people that I talked to that were involved in the program said that they're, especially with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they get reams and reams and reams of actionable intelligence. So when you said it doesn't work, that seems to go against the actual findings of the CIA operatives who actually performed it on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
Well, you know, there's a difference between scientific study and actual programs and anecdotes. Those people, that information has not been made public, and none of that information can be validated. If it took them 10 years to get what you call reams of actionable intelligence, then and they had to sift through everything he said, then he's wasted 10 years of your time.
So was this how it was sold to us at the beginning? Of course not. At the beginning, we were told that the war it would only last a few weeks, that the war was going to be paid for by the oil revenue money, that we weren't going to lose a whole lot of people, that we would win the war in Iraq in absolutely no time, that there was going to be very, very little cost. But as the war went on, a new narrative had to be created, because our actions in Iraq and Afghanistan were creating terrorists. We weren't necessarily killing terrorists. Maybe we were, but there's an old saying. I guess it's my saying. It's a song lyric from a song I wrote back then. And I said, for everyone that dies, it's proven three will rise, unquote. And it's the worst game of pop-up ever, because you knock down one and three more pop up in their place. Which is to say, what your actions are really doing is not defeating terrorism, it's creating terrorism. But the Bush administration and the Republican Party had to come up with a justification. But in the beginning, they said, hey, we're not here to hurt people. We're here to help people. If anybody's hurting anybody, hey, you let me know about it.
If there is somebody captured, and it looks like there may be, I expect those people to be treated humanely. I expect them to be treated, the POWs, I expect to be treated humanely. And just like we're treating the prisoners that we have captured humanely. If not, the people who mistreat the prisoners will be treated as war criminals.
That was what they said. And then they began torturing people. They said, it's not torture, it's enhanced interrogation. And the revisionist history on this has never come to an end. And I don't want anyone to forget, not my children, not you, the listener. I don't want anybody to forget how awful this was. The heat that those of us that were against it, the heat that those of us took over our position against this illegal and immoral bloodbath. We began, in mostly in private conversation, referring to the Iraq war as the meat grinder. Why would you send your kids into the meat grinder? And how dare President Obama try to bring an end to that meat grinder?
A few weeks ago, Dick Cheney says he thinks I'm the worst president of his lifetime. Which is interesting, because I think Dick Cheney is the worst president of my lifetime.
If you turn on Sean Hannity's show especially, and I'm singling him out for a reason. If you turn on his show, he was the biggest cheerleader on the right for the war. And to this day, he refuses to say that there are no weapons of mass destruction, even though there never, ever were. Because he was such a cheerleader for that bloodbath, he can't bring himself to tell the truth about it. October 6th, 2004.
There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there haven't been for a long time. That's not a campaign charge from Senator John Kerry. That's the conclusion of the administration's own weapons inspector, Charles Dulfer, in a voluminous report and personal testimony today. Dulfer said that Saddam Hussein has not produced WMDs since 1991, the end of the first Gulf War. Dulfer did say that Saddam was eager to get back into the WMD business, but his report today flatly contradicts the president's primary reason for going to war against Iraq and the intelligence that led him to that decision.
You've probably been hearing a lot about the 28 pages lately, which are the 28 pages that have not been declassified yet. There's reporting going on right now, but we've been talking about this for about a year. I give you this from Vice, February of last year. The White House says it's finally considering making public 28 controversially redacted pages of a congressional investigation into the terror acts that are said to detail the damning evidence of Saudi government support for Al-Qaeda. Back to this in a minute. The folks in the planes that flew into the towers, that landed in Pennsylvania, that flew into the Pentagon, most of them were Saudis. And Saudi money helped pay for 9/11. But Saudi Arabia, who, by the way, if you're so concerned, Saudi Arabia has public beheadings every week. People busted for stealing. People busted for speaking out against the government. Have their heads cut off in the public square. And this is considered an ally of ours. The joint inquiry into intelligence community activities before and after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001 was issued in December 2002. Many portions, including the entirety of a 28-page section titled Finding Discussions and Narrative regarding certain sensitive national security matters were redacted by the Bush administration on national security grounds, unquote, or so they say. Quoting again, current and former members of Congress who have reviewed the classified pages say that they point to Saudi involvement in the attacks. What those ties were and who precisely is referred to in the pages, however, remains unclear, unquote. Even a year later, it still remains unclear. Quoting from the article again, the deposition of French-born Zacharias Moussaoui, jailed in federal prison on terrorism charges, was introduced as part of a lawsuit brought by relatives of the 9/11 victims against the Saudi government. Moussaoui told lawyers for the plaintiffs that in the late 1990s, he was charged with keeping a list of donors to Al-Qaeda. On it, he said, were the names of the Saudi intelligence chief Prince Turki Al-Faisal, and longtime Saudi ambassador to the United States, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was also lovingly referred to as Bandar Bush because of his close ties with that family. Quoting from the article again, Moussaoui alleges that he encountered eight other high-level officials on several occasions, including Saudi Arabia's current King Salman, who was prince at the time. While based in Afghanistan, Moussaoui said he met with an official from Bandar's office in Washington. Together, the two allegedly planned to bring down Air Force One with a Stinger missile. So, why can't we simply take Masawi's word for it? Well, because he's an unreliable source. He's a proven unreliable source. He has lied in the past. So, why don't we just declassify the 28 pages? Saudi Arabia's record of globally supporting the extreme and austere form of Islam known as Wahhabism, a strand favored by Osama bin Laden and other members of Al-Qaeda. They are the biggest exporter of Wahhabism. So this declassified paper tells us that the war, the entire war, was based on a lie. Then the 28 pages, which have not been disclosed yet, which have not been declassified yet, will tell us who was involved in the 9/11 attacks. But we can't find that out because a certain family member of a guy who just tried to run for president, his name may be listed in there, or hell, the whole damn family may be listed in there.
You know what? As it relates to my brother, there's one thing I know for sure. He kept us safe.
What he meant to say was he kept us safe after 3,000 people got killed in the World Trade Center, and then, of course, after almost 5,000 service members have been killed in the theater of war in the last 13 years, and then, of course, after at least 200,000 Iraqis were slaughtered, and, of course, after, you see where I'm going with this. And I'm not sure if Jeb knows the meaning of the word safe. Tony Blair was an ally of Bush's at the time and also got behind the Iraq War. The headline from CNN, Tony Blair says he's sorry for the Iraq War mistakes. Oh, you're sorry. You just made a mistake.
There have been a lot of questions about Iraq posed to candidates over the last weeks. I've made it very clear that I made a mistake, plain and simple.
In CNN's documentary, Long Road to Hell, America and Iraq, Fareed Zakaria talks with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and he says that he's sorry for mistakes made in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, but that he doesn't regret bringing down dictator Saddam Hussein. Quote, I can say that I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we received was wrong. I'm sorry you gave me the wrong information, even though he had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people, against others. The program, in the form that we thought it was, did not exist in the way that we thought. Unquote. War is once again being promoted by our media. War is once again being promoted by the conservative right, by the Republican Party in America. It's hard to say that they haven't learned anything because they clearly have. They know they have, but they don't care. I'm beginning to think the Republican Party, that that's a religion that is about killing more than anything else. This from Democracy Now. A new analysis of corporate TV has found that there was almost no debate about whether the United States should go to Iraq, to war in Iraq and Syria. The group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found that of the more than 200 guests who appeared on network shows to discuss the issue, just six voiced opposition to military action. The report, titled Debating How, Not Whether, to Launch a New War, examines a two-week period in September when U.S. involvement in Iraq and Syria dominated the airwaves. The report is from 2014. The report also finds that high-profile Sunday talk shows, out of 89 guests, there was just one anti-war voice, and that was Katrina VandenHeuvel, editor of The Nation. And the biggest war, the biggest war that the conservative right in America is promoting right now, is a war against a religion, a war against Islam itself.
Now let's make two things clear. ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslim. And ISIL is certainly not a state. It was formerly Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Iraq and has taken advantage of sectarian strife and serious civil war to gain territory on both sides of the Iraq-Syrian border. It is recognized by no government, nor by the people it subjugates. ISIL is a terrorist organization, pure and simple, and it has no vision other than the slaughter of all who stand in its way.
More than 90% of young people in Iraq now consider the United States to be an enemy of their country, according to a new poll. The poll was conducted by Penn, Schoen-Berlin. This from The Intercept, a public relations and market research firm founded by strategist Mark Penn, and was sponsored by the Dubai-based affiliate Burson Marsteller. The undertaking included 250 face-to-face interviews in three Iraqi cities, plus another 3,250 interviews in 15 other countries throughout the Arab world, all with men and women ages 18 to 24 selected to provide an accurate reflection of each nation's geographic and social economic makeup. It claims an error rate of plus or minus 1.65%. The survey found that overwhelming majorities of young people in Iraq, Yemen, and the Palestinian territories consider the U.S. to be an enemy. Advocates of the 2003 invasion often justified it by claiming that a post-Saddam Iraq would be an ally of U.S. interests in the region. In a speech leading up to the war, then Vice President Dick Cheney cited experts who claimed Iraqis would erupt in joy over the invasion, predicting it would result in strong bonds created between the two countries. But years later, after hundreds of billions of dollars spent and more than 100,000 Iraqis dead, the United States is overwhelmingly considered an enemy by young men and women who were children when the war began. In Yemen, too, where the U.S. conducted an assassination campaign via drones and special forces, where for the past year the U.S. has supported bloody Saudi bombings. Over 80% of respondents described the U.S. as an enemy. These figures are particularly worth noting since the Obama administration has repeatedly cited Yemen as a counterterrorism success story. In recent months, that country has been pummeled by American weapons that have blown up weddings, marketplaces, and rural villages. Far from aiding stability, attacks on the country have in fact helped Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, according to recent reports.
They used to be directed organizations who were directly funded by the former Soviet Union. They were given weapons and equipment through pathways we could clearly identify, and we knew when and where they were just about operating. And they operated in compartmentalization, which means that they didn't communicate with each other. When one group received its weapons, it didn't know how it received its weapons. Weapons magically appeared. They got their weapons. Then their orders would magically appear. And sometimes they didn't even know their commanders. That's not the way that it's worked with the Al-Qaeda organization. They used a sort of mafia-style organization where they operated with a code of omerta. We used to say, catch one, you've got them all. Everybody within the cell does logistics. Everybody in the cell does laundry. Everybody builds weapons. Everybody goes out and dies in a suicide bombing. ISIS is that model on steroids.
This from the Washington Examiner. The headline, Price of Iraq-Afghan War Hits a Staggering $6 trillion. This is a projection. Quote, the final price tag of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan could reach $6 trillion, 50% more than the whole federal government spends in a year. As a consequence of these wartime spending choices, the United States will face constraints in funding investments in personnel and diplomacy, research and development, and new military initiatives, wrote Anthony H. Kordsman in the Fiscal Year 2016 Defense Budget and U.S. Strategy, Key Trends and Data Points. He added, The legacy of decisions taken during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars will dominate future federal budgets for decades to come. His 141-page report is a powerhouse analysis of the defense and federal budget, but it is the massive cost of two wars that jumped out on first reading. CSIS also provided a detailed executive summary. Using his calculations with others, Korsman put the cost of the ongoing conflicts at $4 to $6 trillion, with an estimated $3.37 trillion already spent. If you look at the federal budget right now, more than half of what we spend is spent by the Pentagon, is spent on the military. More than half of the federal budget. And a lot of that goes to the ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as other theaters of war that the Republicans would really, really, really like to start up and start up very, very soon. Thank you very much. But if you ask a conservative, they will tell you that we are being bankrupted by Social Security, bankrupted by how much these public workers want to make. Police, fire, they make too much money. Bankrupted by people who are on food stamps. Those things are a teeny tiny pinch. Food stamps are a part of the agricultural part of the budget, and the agricultural part of the budget is less than 1%, and that's not all food stamps. Very little of it is, and that money is spent here in America at grocery stores, and then they spend that money buying more things. That money has a multiplier effect. When you put $1 billion into a bomb, drop that bomb, kill a bunch of people, and create a bunch of enemies, you've gotten nothing for the money that you've spent and only made things worse. There's no multiplier effect for that, unless you're talking about how many more terrorists will be created as a result of dropping that bomb. And then to suggest, after what we did in the Middle East, what we did in the theater of war, to suggest that we should wage a larger war, this time against an entire religion, is unforgivable.
I think I heard also, is this true? I don't know whether this is true or not, but Cruz said we should start patrolling Muslim neighborhoods or something. Is that true?
And waterboarding.
Well, look, my sense of it is that we are not at war with Islam. We're at war with radical Islam. Secondly, in our country, we don't want to create divisions where we say, okay, well, your religion, you're a Muslim, so therefore we're going to keep an eye on you.
That's John Kasich. And probably, in my estimation, the reason why he's not doing as well as he could have in the presidential field is because he's talking like that. Because if you listen to Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, they're saying shut down Muslims. They're saying patrol Muslim neighborhoods. They're saying we should not only do more bombing, but we should also do more waterboarding and this is a quote, and worse. We should be doing worse. Because clearly, what we've done so far is working so well already. The people of Flint, Michigan are being poisoned by their water. Now, I've heard you can live for up to, depending on who you are, up to a week, maybe even 2 weeks without food. But you can't live more than a few days without water. Water is the most important thing that your body needs. Your body is more than 80% water. And you need new water all the time to sustain it. In a cost-cutting measure, the governor, the Republican governor, in a measure of austerity, decided to switch the water pipes in that town, or to switch the source of water for the water pipes in that town. And now the entire town is being poisoned. We talked about this on the show. Lead poisoning, hurting people. People are getting skin lesions. People are getting sick. People cannot drink out of their taps. They cannot cook with it. They can't even bathe with it because it has, some of it is tens of thousands of parts per million in lead. And we're also being told, no, we cannot help the people of Flint, Michigan. War, yes, please. We will take more war. Help the people of Flint, Michigan, who were poisoned by their Republican governor, Governor Snyder, because he wanted to privatize the water sources in that town, take care of those people? I'm sorry, you can't do that.
You know, when I think about Flint and what's happening there, and people say, well, you know how much money it will cost to rebuild Flint? That's expensive. But somehow, when we talk about rebuilding Flint, Michigan, very expensive. But when we went to war in Iraq, the trillions we spent there, not a problem.
Everybody has their issue. My issue is this. It's war. Yeah, yeah, I get into the other things too. I get into marriage equality. I get into all that. But for me, this is the big, glaring, horrible issue to me. Back during 2003, I felt like I was screaming into the wind. All of this blowback. And my words meant absolutely nothing, and they went nowhere. Landed on deaf ears. I said, this is gonna, and I'm nobody. I'm an absolute nobody sitting behind this microphone. I said, this is gonna get us nothing. We're gonna spend a lot of money. We're gonna get an awful lot of people killed, and we're gonna get nothing in return for it. Turns out I was wrong. We've gotten tons in return for it, but every bit of it has been negative. And my biggest issue in this campaign, and I'm once again screaming into the wind, and what I'm saying is falling upon deaf ears. Because apparently, all these soldiers getting killed, that means nothing. All this money being spent means nothing. Unless, of course, you want to spend money to help people, then F you, Melvin. I'm sorry. Who the hell do you think you are? So Bernie Sanders is my candidate. Bernie Sanders became my candidate right away. Somebody who is as anti-war as I am. Not anti-defense, not anti-defending ourselves, but against these illegal and unnecessary wars. But the Democratic Party, who has parted with me once again, has decided that she, who voted for the Iraq war.
There have been a lot of questions about Iraq posed to candidates over the last weeks. I've made it very clear that I made a mistake, plain and simple.
Yeah, I'm fine. We get it. You're sorry. The Democratic Party has decided, and along with a lot of the Democratic constituency, has decided that is who they want to run in the general election. The Republican Party, Reince Priebus, I've heard him say it. Sean Hannity, I've heard him say it. They really want her to be the nominee because they're pretty sure they have all that they need to defeat her. And American Crossroads, which, by the way, no friend to the Democratic Party, no friend to progressives, has already started running anti-Hillary ads. There's one running right now comparing her to Richard Nixon.
What I have stated from the beginning to be the truth has been the truth.
I want people to understand what the truth is.
I am confident the American people will come to realize I have not violated the trust.
I am confident that by the end of this campaign, people will know they can trust me.
The entire story is there.
I turned over everything I was obligated to turn over.
I want the facts out.
I want those emails out.
I'm sorry, I just hope I haven't let you down.
I'm sorry about that. I take responsibility.
It's hard to say what's going to happen in the fall election, but here is what is clear at this point. The folks who are left in the presidential race are the folks who are the most hawkish, the folks who are most likely to take us to war. Yes, Cruz and Trump are openly saying that they can't wait to take us into more war, and Hillary is being kind of iffy about it. But it's pretty clear that we've forgotten all the lessons of Vietnam, all the lessons of Iraq and Afghanistan, that we just simply turn a blind eye to the fact that the VA has an 18-month backup right now, that we're losing a veteran a day to suicide because they can't get the care they need because we're too busy spending war money on making more veterans. Forgive me if I get out of control about this. Forgive me if I get too hot about this. This is an upsetting issue to me, and I'm watching my countrymen forget everything they've learned and turn to more war hawks. Perhaps when Hillary Clinton says we can't do the big things that Bernie Sanders wants to do, healthcare, education, perhaps the reason we can't do those big things is not because they are too big, not because they are out of reach, and not because we can't come together and make those things happen. Perhaps the reason she says we can't do those things is because she is planning on spending more money on war. It's not simply enough to say that you made a mistake. But once again, for me, I'm screaming into the wind. Ladies and gentlemen, Thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. And we're also on Kiwi Station. Find us over there as well. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean or Kiwi Station. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are The Fire You Can't Put Out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing. And a special thanks to you for listening. One more thing before I go. I understand that what I've laid before you seems like a lot. And you feel like you have to go out and do a lot. You have to do something. That's for sure. But honestly, it's the simplest answer. The answer isn't when do we go to war? Who do we attack? But if. And there's a 99.9% chance that the answer is no. This is Melvin, signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.